Chapter 2. Values. The inside of the White House doesn't have the luminous quality that you might expect from TV or film. It seems well kept but worn, a big old house that one imagines might be a bit drafty on cold winter nights. Still, as I stood in the foyer and let my eyes wander down the corridors, it was impossible to forget the history that had been made there. JFK and Bobby Kennedy huddling over the Cuban Missile Crisis, FDR making last-minute changes to a radio address, Lincoln alone, pacing the halls and shouldering the weight of a nation. I was greeted immediately by a member of the White House legislative staff and led into the Gold Room, where most of the incoming House and Senate members had already gathered. At 1600 hours on the dot, President Bush was announced and walked to the podium, looking vigorous and fit, with that jaunty, determined walk that suggests he's on a schedule and wants to keep detours to a minimum. For 10 minutes or so, he spoke to the room, making a few jokes, calling for the country to come together, before inviting us to the other end of the White House for refreshments and a picture with him and the First Lady. I happened to be starving at that moment, so while most of the other legislators started lining up for their photographs, I headed for the buffet. As I munched on hors d'oeuvres and engaged in small talk with a handful of House members, I recalled my previous two encounters with the President, the first a brief congratulatory call after the election, the second a small White House breakfast with me and the other incoming senators. Both times I had found the President to be a likable man, shrewd and disciplined, but with the same straightforward manner that had helped him win two elections. You could easily imagine him owning the local car dealership down the street, coaching Little League, and grilling in his backyard, the kind of guy that would make for good company so long as the conversation revolved around sports and the kids. "Senator?" I looked up, shaken out of my memory, and saw one of the older black men who made up most of the White House wait staff standing next to me. "Want me to take that plate for you?" I nodded, trying to swallow a mouthful of chicken something or others, and noticed that the line to greet the President had evaporated. Wanting to thank my hosts, I headed toward the blue room. A young Marine at the door politely indicated that the photograph session was over and that the President needed to get to his next appointment. But before I could turn around to go, the President himself appeared in the doorway and waved me in. "Obama," the President said, shaking my hand. "Come here and meet Laura. Laura, you remember Obama. We saw him on TV during election night. Beautiful family. And that wife of yours, that's one impressive lady." "We both got better than we deserve, Mr. President," I said, shaking the First Lady's hand and hoping that I'd wiped any crumbs off my face. The President turned to an aide nearby, who squirted a big dollop of hand sanitizer in the President's hand. "Want some?" the President asked. "Good stuff. Keeps you from getting colds." Not wanting to seem unhygienic, I took a squirt. "Come over here for a second," he said, leading me off to one side of the room. "You know," he said quietly, "I hope you don't mind me giving you a piece of advice." "Not at all, Mr. President." He nodded. "You've got a bright future," he said. "Very bright. But I've been in this town a while, and let me tell you, it can be tough. When you get a lot of attention, like you've been getting, people start gunning for you. And it won't necessarily be just coming from my side, you understand. From yours, too. Everybody will be waiting for you to slip. Know what I mean? So watch yourself." "Thanks for the advice, Mr. President." "All right. I got to get along. You know, me and you got something in common." "What's that?" "We both had to debate Alan Keyes. That guy's a piece of work, isn't he?" I laughed, and as we walked to the door, I told him a few stories from the campaign. It wasn't until he had left the room that I realized I had briefly put my arm over his shoulder as we talked, an unconscious habit of mine, but one that I suspected might have made many of my friends, not to mention the Secret Service agents in the room, more than a little uneasy. Since my arrival in the Senate, I've been a steady and occasionally fierce critic of Bush administration policies. So Democratic audiences are often surprised when I tell them that I don't consider George Bush a bad man, and I assume that he and members of his administration are trying to do what they think is best for the country. I say this not because I'm seduced by the proximity to power. I see my invitations to the White House for what they are, exercises in common political courtesy, and am mindful of how quickly the long knives can come out when the administration's agenda is threatened in any serious way. Moreover, when I write a letter to a family who's lost a loved one in Iraq, or read an email from a constituent who has dropped out of college because her student aid has been cut, I'm reminded that the actions of those in power have enormous consequences, a price that they themselves almost never have to pay. It is to say that after all the trappings of office, the titles, the staff, the security details are stripped away, I find the president and the men and women who surround him to be pretty much like everyone else, possessed of the same mix of virtues and vices, insecurities and long-buried injuries as the rest of us. No matter how wrong-headed I might consider their policies to be, and no matter how much I might insist that they be held accountable for the results of such policies, I still found it possible, in talking to these men, to understand their motives and to recognize in them values I shared. Outside of Washington, America feels less deeply divided. Illinois, for example, is no longer considered a bellwether state. For more than a decade now, it's become more and more democratic, partly because of increased urbanization, partly because the social conservatism of today's GOP doesn't wear well in the land of Lincoln. But Illinois remains a microcosm of the country, a rough stew of north and south, east and west, urban and rural, black, white, and everything in between. Chicago may possess all the big city sophistication of L.A. or New York, but geographically and culturally, the southern end of Illinois is closer to Little Rock or Louisville, and large swaths of the state are considered, in modern political parlance, a deep shade of red. I first traveled through southern Illinois in 1997. It was the summer after my first term in the Illinois legislature, and Michelle and I were not yet parents. With session adjourned, no law school classes to teach, and Michelle busy with work of her own, I convinced my aide, Dan Shulman, to toss a map and some golf clubs in the car and tool around the state for a week. Dan had been both a UPI reporter and field coordinator for several downstate campaigns, so he knew the territory pretty well. But as the date of our departure approached, it became apparent that he wasn't quite sure how I would be received in the counties we were planning to visit. Four times he reminded me how to pack. Just khakis and polo shirts, he said. No fancy linen trousers or silk shirts. I assured him that I didn't own any linens or silks. We stopped in a coffee shop to eat pie and swap jokes with the mayor of Chester. We posed in front of the 15-foot-tall statue of Superman at the center of Metropolis. We heard about all the young people who were moving to the big cities because manufacturing and coal mining jobs were disappearing. We learned about the local high school football team's prospects for the coming season, and the vast distances veterans had to drive in order to reach the closest VA facility. We met women who had been missionaries in Kenya and greeted me in Swahili, and farmers who tracked the financial pages of the Wall Street Journal before setting out on their tractors. Several times a day, I pointed out to Dan the number of men we met sporting white linen slacks or silk Hawaiian shirts. By the end of the week, I was sorry to leave, not simply because I had made so many new friends, but because in the faces of all the men and women I'd met, I had recognized pieces of myself. In them, I saw my grandfather's openness, my grandmother's matter-of-factness, my mother's kindness. The fried chicken, the potato salad, the grape halves in the jello mold, all of it felt familiar. It's that sense of familiarity that strikes me whenever I travel across Illinois. I feel it when I'm sitting down at a diner on Chicago's west side. I feel it as I watch Hispanic men play soccer while their families cheer them on in a park in Pilsen. I feel it when I'm attending an Indian wedding in one of Chicago's northern suburbs. Not so far beneath the surface, I think, we are becoming more, not less, alike. I don't mean to exaggerate here, to suggest that the pollsters are wrong and that our differences, racial, religious, regional, or economic, are somehow trivial. It is to insist that across Illinois and across America, a constant cross-pollination is occurring, a not entirely orderly but generally peaceful collision among people and cultures. Identities are scrambling and then cohering in new ways. Beliefs keep slipping through the noose of predictability. Facile expectations and simple explanations are being constantly upended. Spend time actually talking to Americans, and you discover that most evangelicals are more tolerant than the media would have us believe. Most secularists, more spiritual. Most rich people want the poor to succeed. And most of the poor are both more self-critical and hold higher aspirations than the popular culture allows. Most Republican strongholds are 40% Democrat, and vice versa. The political labels of liberal and conservative rarely track people's personal attributes. All of which raises the question, what are the core values that we, as Americans, hold in common? That's not how we usually frame the issue, of course. Our political culture fixates on where our values clash. In the immediate aftermath of the 2004 election, for example, a major national exit poll was published in which voters ranked moral values as having determined how they cast their ballot. Commentators fastened on the data to argue that the most controversial social issues in the election, particularly gay marriage, had swung a number of states. Conservatives heralded the numbers, convinced that they proved the Christian right's growing power. When these polls were later analyzed, it turned out that the pundits and prognosticators had overstated their case a bit. In fact, voters had considered national security as the most important issue of the race, and although large numbers of voters did consider moral values as an important factor in the way they voted, the meaning of the term was so vague as to include everything from abortion to corporate malfeasance. Immediately, some Democrats could be heard breathing a sigh of relief, as if a diminution in the values factor served the liberal cause, as if a discussion of values was a dangerous, unnecessary distraction from those material concerns that characterized the Democratic Party platform. I think Democrats are wrong to run away from a debate about values, as wrong as those conservatives who see values only as a wedge to pry loose working-class voters from the Democratic base. It is the language of values that people use to map their world. It is what can inspire them to take action and move them beyond their isolation. The post-election polls may have been poorly composed, but the broader question of shared values, the standards and principles that the majority of Americans deem important in their lives and the life of the country, should be at the heart of our politics, the cornerstone of any meaningful debate about budgets and projects, regulations and policies. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Those simple words are our starting point as Americans. They describe not only the foundation of our government, but the substance of our common creed. Not every American may be able to recite them. Few, if asked, could trace the genesis of the Declaration of Independence to its roots in 18th century liberal and Republican thought. But the essential idea behind the Declaration, that we are born into this world free, all of us, that each of us arrives with a bundle of rights that can't be taken away by any man or any state without just cause, that through our own agency we can and must make of our lives what we will, is one that every American understands. It orients us, sets our course, each and every day. Indeed, the value of individual freedom is so deeply ingrained in Americans that we tend to take it for granted. It's easy to forget that at the time of the founding, this idea was entirely radical in its implications, as radical as Martin Luther's posting on the church door. It is an idea that some portion of the world still rejects, and for which an even larger portion of humanity finds scant evidence in their lives. At its most elemental level, we understand our liberty in a negative sense. As a general rule, we believe in the right to be left alone and are suspicious of those, whether big brother or nosy neighbors, who want to meddle in our business. But we understand our liberty in a more positive sense as well, in the idea of opportunity and the subsidiary values that help realize opportunity. All those homespun virtues that Benjamin Franklin first popularized in Poor Richard's Almanac, and have continued to inspire our allegiance through successive generations. The values of self-reliance and self-improvement and risk-taking, the values of drive, discipline, temperance, and hard work, the values of thrift and personal responsibility. These values are rooted in a basic optimism about life and a faith in free will, a confidence that through pluck and sweat and smarts, each of us can rise above the circumstances of our birth. But these values also express a broader confidence that so long as individual men and women are free to pursue their own interests, society as a whole will prosper. Our system of self-government and our free market economy depend on the majority of individual Americans adhering to these values. The legitimacy of our government and our economy depend on the degree to which these values are rewarded, which is why the values of equal opportunity and non-discrimination complement rather than impinge on our liberty. If we Americans are individualistic at heart, if we instinctively chafe against a past of tribal allegiances, traditions, customs, and castes, it would be a mistake to assume that this is all we are. Our individualism has always been bound by a set of communal values, the glue upon which every healthy society depends. We value the imperatives of family and the cross-generational obligations that family implies. We value community, the neighborliness that expresses itself through raising the barn or coaching the soccer team. We value patriotism and the obligations of citizenship, a sense of duty and sacrifice on behalf of our nation. We value a faith in something bigger than ourselves, whether that something expresses itself in formal religion or ethical precepts. And we value the constellation of behaviors that express our mutual regard for one another. Honesty, fairness, humility, kindness, courtesy, and compassion. In every society, and in every individual, these twin strands, the individualistic and the communal, autonomy and solidarity, are in tension. And it has been one of the blessings of America that the circumstances of our nation's birth allowed us to negotiate these tensions better than most. We did not have to go through any of the violent upheavals that Europe was forced to endure as it shed its feudal past. Our passage from an agricultural to an industrial society was eased by the sheer size of the continent, vast tracts of land and abundant resources that allowed new immigrants to continually remake themselves. But we can't avoid these tensions entirely. At times, our values collide because in the hands of men, each one is subject to distortion and excess. Self-reliance and independence can transform into selfishness and license, ambition into greed and a frantic desire to succeed at any cost. More than once in our history, we've seen patriotism slide into jingoism, xenophobia, the stifling of dissent. We've seen faith calcify into self-righteousness, close-mindedness, and a cruelty towards others. Finding the right balance between our competing values is difficult. Tensions arise not because we have steered a wrong course, but simply because we live in a difficult and contradictory world. I firmly believe, for example, that since 9/11, we've been fast and loose with constitutional principles in the fight against terrorism. But I acknowledge that even the wisest president and the most prudent Congress would struggle to balance the critical demands of our collective security against the equally compelling need to uphold civil liberties. I believe our economic policies pay too little attention to the displacement of manufacturing workers and the destruction of manufacturing towns. But I cannot wish away the sometimes competing demands of economic security and competitiveness. Unfortunately, too often in our national debates, we don't even get to the point where we weigh these difficult choices. Instead, we either exaggerate the degree to which policies we don't like impinge on our most sacred values, or play dumb when our own preferred policies conflict with important countervailing values. Conservatives, for instance, tend to bristle when it comes to government interference in the marketplace or their right to bear arms. Yet many of these same conservatives show little to no concern when it comes to government wiretapping without a warrant, or government attempts to control people's sexual practices. Conversely, it's easy to get most liberals riled up about government encroachments on freedom of the press or women's reproductive freedoms. But if you have a conversation with these same liberals about the potential costs of regulation to a small businessman, you will often draw a blank stare. In a country as diverse as ours, there will always be passionate arguments about how we draw the line when it comes to government action. That is how our democracy works. But our democracy might work a bit better if we recognize that all of us possess values that are worthy of respect. If liberals at least acknowledged that the recreational hunter feels the same way about his gun as they feel about their library books, and if conservatives recognized that most women feel as protective of their right to reproductive freedom as evangelicals are of their right to worship. Sometimes politicians and interest groups welcome conflict in pursuit of a broader ideological goal. Most anti-abortion activists, for example, have openly discouraged legislative allies from even pursuing those compromise measures that would have significantly reduced the incidence of partial birth abortion, because the image the procedure evokes in the mind of the public has helped them win converts to their position. And sometimes our ideological predispositions are just so fixed that we have trouble seeing the obvious. Once, while still in the Illinois Senate, I listened to a Republican colleague work himself into a lather over a proposed plan to provide school breakfasts to preschoolers. Such a plan, he insisted, would crush these children's spirit of self-reliance. I had to point out that not too many 5-year-olds I knew were self-reliant,